You are tuned to KBOO, Portland.
Andy, whoa, whoa, looks a scream. Had him on my whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy, whoa, whoa, silver scream. Can't tell them apart at all.
This is Art Focus, and I am Aurora Josephson, presenting the fourth in a series of studio visits with artists during the pandemic. My guest today is Hank Pander. Mr. Pander is a reluctant but ever-present artist in the Portland artist scene, having lived here since 1965. His degree in 1961 is from the Rijksakademie in Amsterdam, when he also won the silver medal at the Prix de Rome. His current subject matter ranges from the plague to the pandemic to the recent Portland demonstrations. This interview was recorded during my second studio visit with Hank Pander. You may find panorama pictures of his studios, in addition to a selection of recent works, including the ones we discuss in this interview, on my website, aurorajosephson.com. I am here with Hank Pander in his studio, and we are going to continue on with my series of visits during the pandemic to artists in the studio and just checking up and seeing how the pandemic is affecting your work, if at all. Basically, what you're up to during the pandemic, if it's affected your process, or is it the same old for you?
Well, same old, same old. It's, I make sort of, most of my work has been narrative paintings over years. I'm also an immigrant, so I have a way of sort of being somewhat detached from this world around me, and at the same time, I see things happening around me which I find emotionally effective and at times disturbing and at times really quite frightening. And I didn't grow up in a world like that, so as I am here, over this last year, completely isolated from anybody, I also have a tendency to feel more and more like an exile, like I don't belong here. A kind of sense of foreignness and isolation and detachment, in a sense. Mm-hmm. It's kind of reinforced by the art community, which hasn't really embraced me open arms because they can't sell my work, they don't really want to handle the seriousness of my subject matter and stuff. So all of that together has made me drawn more into myself, but at the same time also, since I don't have, you know, I have to worry about making a living, but I don't have dealers or people sort of lurking over my shoulders and we can't place that and we can't, that's too scary and stuff. I'm too old for that too, so I've sort of done away with that. And I'm starting to paint things which affect me and which are really about this time and period we are living, and it's an extremely powerful, rich period. And so when these things started happening last summer in the city with Black Lives Matter, and I was at the time the founder of the Visual Chronicle, I've always oftentimes chronicled the environment in which I live and responded to it. I felt it would be interesting to sort of look at this small neighborhood with these buildings and what was going on there. And at the same time, I started looking at these buildings in the city as a whole, as it became more deteriorated, become more affected by it, and also how these buildings, which are, you know, sort of postmodernist, elegant, clever, huge buildings, took on the sense of ominousness and kind of disturbing. The scale of these buildings all of a sudden became sort of like somewhat threatening if you see what was happening underneath it by demonstrators being shot at and fires and mayhem and all that. So I went down there times and did studies there, did photo documentation, made drawings, and then started transposing some of these images into these paintings. So I made like four fairly substantial paintings dealing with what happens in the age of Trump downtown Portland.
So looking at one right here, which we will post, but it is underneath,
It's underneath the corridor of the Hatfield Courthouse.
Okay.
The corridor out there.
Oh, I see the color, the pink color now.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so on this corridor, inside this building, was the federal police, and there was fences around it, and then around there were demonstrations.
Okay.
And so these demonstrations quickly deteriorated in this incredible violence. And so this painting, I have done a fair amount of research. I also photographed with my on my iPad these people who would follow all what's going on, you know, with the tracking it. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up with an enormous body of photo documentation about what happened there, far more than I could need. And so this painting is sort of a result of that.
And there's billowing, looks like tear gas coming up.
That's tear gas, yeah.
And then there's people in riot gear.
Yeah, it's kind of violent.
Yeah.
And they're involved in firing.
And there's an overturned safety cone. I like that,
yeah,
that picture a lot.
Yeah.
So it does capture the chaos.
Yeah, so it's spatial. It's, you know, it's dimensional. It's richly colored. It has a really sense of light and composition. So it's also, as a painting, a very vivid, well-considered work.
I find the perspective really interesting underneath the awnings stretching out as they are. And the depth that you get is really remarkable.
Yeah.
So how, if at all, has COVID changed the art-making process for you? Has it changed anything?
Well, I started work making paintings about it because, you know, I became quickly aware that a lot of innocent people would die by the thousands. I mean, there's just some incredible tragedy.
Yeah.
What happened in early in New York and stuff, and this huge piles of bodies which were stuck into refrigerator trucks, and there's just some incredible, painful, and tragic events. But at the same time, I don't really want to make directly paintings about it, but more about a kind of a historic setting where similar things happened, but it also sort of detached from the moment in a sense, so it becomes kind of a metaphor.
Like the painting you shared with me downstairs of the taxidermy birds.
That's the first kind of metaphor painting of these dead birds sort of collapsed into still life, as if they had those beautiful animals that just met their demise in this sort of tomb-like setting. I also, over the years, you know, long before COVID, I've always been sort of conscious of the fact that with this vast human population, like maybe 9 billion people living on the planet, deterioration of the atmosphere and the incredible disruption of the natural world, that if some virus would rise to the surface, it could really cause incredible damage the whole world over. And if there were a virus which nobody could do anything about, it would kill billions of people. We would be in a situation which was indescribable. In a sense, we're lucky that we're not. However, about 10 years ago, I bought at Powell's, I bought a book. I picked up a book. I have it here. This book.
The Great Mortality.
The Great Mortality by John Kelly. And it describes in detail what happened to the plague in the 14th century. How it arose, how it traveled along the coasts and cities, how it affected cities, and people not knowing what to do about it, how it just devastated populations, and ultimately it killed nearly 50% of the world population in a very, very short time.
And you have this painting, Plague Ships Fleeing the Burning City of Kaffa.
Yeah, so Kaffa. Kaffa was a city, it's still there actually, in Crimea, in the Black Sea. And in the Black Sea was an Italian trading post, a harbor, and they imported, you know, goods out of China, the Far East, put them on ships, and then brought them into Western Europe and made lots of money. So that was, over time, was a really very affluent trading post way deep into the Far East. What happened also in the Far East, in Mongolia, were these steppes, these rolling hills, vast, unpopulated, vast landscapes. And in these steppes, there were kind of marmots, kind of rat-like creatures living there for like thousands of years. And if these marmot populations became too big, and they became sort of weakened, and there was not enough food, and so there was a plague, bacillus, which would get into these marmots and die back all these marmots until it became a small group. And in the meantime, the plague bacillus died too, because they didn't have any more bird animals to kill and stuff. And so this was this sort of symbiotic relationship between these bacillus in the Far East and these marmots. So what happened? That in the 12th century, the Italians, Marco Polo, traveled all the way to China and discovered all the riches of China and started this trade between China, and then traveling on these camel trains to Kaffa, and had these products with them travel the world over. Also, the Mongolian Genghis Khan and his buddies, they thought these Italians were really decadent and obnoxious and arrogant and stuff, and they hated them. And so when the Mongolian army became bigger and more powerful, they decided to kill all those Italians and started a war, a siege to the city of Kaffa, and surrounded it. These Mongolian armies also came through these plague-invested areas, and the fleas of these creatures jumped onto the horses and the clothes and all that, and sort of started affecting these soldiers. And the plague got into the Mongolian army while they were also fighting the Italians. And the Mongolians got so many dead bodies, their army was dying so fast, that they had, in the Middle Ages, they had these huge trebuchets, these big catapults, and they started catapulting plague-infested bodies into the city of Kaffa and infected also the city of Kaffa with the plague.
Wow.
The Mongolians gave up, and they pulled back, and the folks, the Italians, got into their ships, all sick with the plague, and sailed to Constantinople and Sicily, and gradually spread the plague throughout Europe, and it caught on, since nobody knew where it came from and stuff, and hygiene was like poor and all that. Mm-hmm. It spread, and like say in England, it killed like some parts, all the population, half the population. And mm-hmm. in Paris, in France, in Avignon, in it's just the stories in this book are just beyond description, unbelievable.
And so you used some of this book and made that.
Yeah, and so I thought about that 10 years ago, and I thought, God, it'd be incredibly powerful to do a series of works dealing with that body work. Then COVID happens, and all of a sudden this book started sort of shining. And I said, it's time to reread this.
Yeah.
Also, I started doing research on the internet, started looking at 14th century ships, the clothes people wore, you know, the kind of period and sense of that. And there was a lot of this also out of this period, a lot of images of the plague itself, about what happened to people, you know, just horrible. And so I started gathering some of the source material, and sort of based on that, I started making small drawings in a sketchbook and filled like this, pretty much a sketchbook full of like little, you know, thumbprint drawings.
So they're like,
and then I can show you it.
Okay.
And so then I went and picked through that, and then I started gradually proposing some of these drawings into these large watercolors. But I also thought somewhat morbidly. But there's sort of this sense about the United States is declining. There's kind of a real sense about, this was a great country when I came here in the 60s. It's not anymore. It's a dreadful place. There's poverty. There's boarded up windows. This is just really basically indescribable here. And I thought maybe it sort of looks also like the fall of empire. Mm. And so I also have a really great book by the works of Piranesi, who in the 18th century made those extremely beautiful engravings of the city of Rome and whatever was left in Rome. So I have this beautiful series of etchings I can look at. And so what I did with these paintings, rather than set them in a Renaissance, I set them in Rome, in this, you know, and not literally so, but I used these ruins and these old neoclassical or classical buildings as settings for these paintings. And so as I was doing that, it became extremely compelling, you know, just like, oh my God, what am I painting here, you know? And so then, and I had the plan sort of to make a couple of more oil paintings based on this material, but I thought before I started working on these paintings, I should do a whole series of color studies and then see where it gets me before I start working on these paintings. So that's kind of what you see around here, are all these watercolors in these plague-riddled cities,
okay,
with these Roman ruins in it. But the Roman ruins in these buildings also are like empty, as if they were abandoned or nobody lives it anymore. So it also has this,
the windows are all dark.
Yeah, they're all dark, and it has this hint of like abandonment.
Yes.
And then of course,
and then there's a doorway kind of, or is that, what is that rampart coming up with the faces coming out of it? It's,
well,
very dramatic.
There's a fair amount of old prints out of the primarily of this 16th and 17th century about these very, because there's Ferris plague epidemics, so there's lots of work having been done about it. And so there are lots of stories
wagon.
About this.
I see it now. There's a wagon wheel.
It's a wagon, yeah.
Yes.
It's a cart, and the cart is covered in bodies, and the bodies are sliding into,
oof,
this plague pit.
Very gruesome.
Yeah, it's gruesome, but it's also,
but well executed.
Well, yeah, they're also, you know, I have an audience, maybe you may not like this, but I have a real problem with contemporary art and contemporary decorative paintings which can be placed in public buildings and homes and all that, which are uplifting and feel good and nice and wonderful. I love the colors. I don't think that is a really a motivation to make fine art. Fine art really is like literature. It deals with the human condition. It deals with loss. It deals with emptiness. It deals with death. It deals with serious issues in which you can look at these paintings and sort of recognize something about yourself and what it's like to be alive, and that kind of makes fine art, in my opinion. And so I like to make serious paintings, and so it's also, in a sense, not necessarily a reaction, but it's a choice I'm making from, this is the kind of paintings we need to make, and not all this.
I was going to ask you, what is it, because there seems to be a thread involving heroic disasters in your work.
Well,
talking about the Kaffa and the plague,
yeah,
and then the,
well,
demonstrations, the decline of civilization.
I am drawn towards, I used to work in the theater, so the idea of conflict,
okay,
blocking, resolution, lighting, blocking, all these kind of things which play a role in the theater also play a role in my paintings. And I also think that painting should have emotional depth. It should touch you. You should see a painting of mine and keep thinking about it and say, what the hell is that?
Mm.
I can't get it out of my head. And so it becomes more than just a pretty picture, but it becomes sort of more meaningful in
it's
a way. So
burned that Kaffa painting with the ship on, you know, in flames, and then the bodies along the shore. It's burned in my mind.
Yeah,
after
yeah.
looking at it for just a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, and those are also, it's set in Rome, these big columns and arches and stuff of the city of Rome, but the ship itself is period out of the 14th century. I'll tell you that these galleys, people used to row in galleys from the Egyptians and the Greeks all the way up to the 16th century. So this way of moving ships in galleys was sort of timeless, and it was really in the 17th century when people started building bigger ships and put them on the full sail and did away with all the heavy duty rowing and all that, that the galley sort of faded off the face of, you know, civilization. But so these galleys are also very powerful historical images, but also it's like these, you know, rows of like guys, you know, like maybe two rows of like 40 guys all going through the Mediterranean with waves and all that, rowing the ship, the force of that and the discipline of that and all that, the strength it would take was indescribable. And so oftentimes there were like galley slaves, and galley slaves, they would, you know, they were slaves, and they would just say, "Oh, that, no, I work really hard." So they ended up later on in time using like citizens of, say, Genoa or Venice and stuff, who had an interest in the survival of the state. So then, if you think about it, then these ships got into the Mediterranean, and in the meantime, people on the ships were dying. And so these ships would end up in Marseille, and there would be a ship coming there, and all the people were dead on board. And they would try to keep these people away, but people were so desperate, they get on shore anyway. And so they couldn't keep this disease at bay, but the horror on these ships, of course, all these people dying and the rowing and sailing and stuff along these coastlines, and the following of trade routes in the 14th century is very much like following these diseases out now. It's, you know, following trade routes now, other than they don't have ships, but they use aircraft and airports and all that. But the principle of like these diseases moving around the world, mm-hmm. is universal. Also the fact that people didn't know what it was, where this disease came from. People wear strange masks and they had mythical notions. They thought the Jews did it, so they murdered all the Jews they could have and stuff. There was just incredible other kind of scenes as a result which happened in relation to it, out of sheer despair because people didn't know where it came from. And in the beginning with COVID, we had a similar kind of issue. You know, now we have the advances of high technology and medical science, so we can maybe penetrate this a little bit better. But I'll tell you, this ain't over. This ain't over at all.
And we've got variants now as well.
Huh?
We have the variants now,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah,
so.
And who knows?
You mentioned during my last visit that you have a practice, and you've been doing this during COVID times, of setting up skeletons in your studio, mm-hmm. like suspending them from the ceiling,
yeah,
and
yeah.
then doing life sketch
yeah.
drawings.
I've been doing those. I started out with doing these. I build a big still life here on the podium, and then use my bird collection, and then build kind of a wall in it, like a building, a structure out of bricks I have here, and build this kind of tomb-like curved wall, and place these birds sort of in the mud and the gravel and the stuff around there, as if they had all sort of died in this still life, you know, as a kind of metaphor. And it also would be also an opportunity to really paint these beautiful birds as well. So it's painted from nature, it's carefully observed,
right.
but at the same time it also has a sort of depth to it. Is more than just a cute picture of a bunch of birds. It has an other layer to it, which makes the painting interesting.
And I'm fascinated by the idea of suspending the skeleton from the ceiling, you said?
Yeah.
That sounds amazing.
I do that. I haven't done it for a while, but I'll tell you, I'm having fantasies about it. See that rack up there?
Yes.
Well, I can someday build still as there, it fills a whole back wall. There's also tradition in 17th century painting called Vanitas painting.
And that idea of what painting, sorry?
Vanitas. The idea is that everything is vanity. Remember, we'll all die and stuff, so you can't take it with you and all that. So these, but that's neither here nor there. But some of these Vanitas paintings are also extremely beautiful. They have beautiful books in it often, because you can't take learning to heaven with you and stuff, and gold platters, because you can't, it's all meaningless and all that. And oftentimes there's skulls in it too. And that tradition of painting still lifes, I really like.
Okay.
So,
and it's called Vanitas.
But there's also
Oh, I see. Oh, there's a picture. Oh, that's so neat.
It's also an element of like the great extinction, the sixth extinction of the whole animal kingdom dying back. So the demise of the animal kingdom, and I find these animals in the desert and all that, and I put them together, and this is a photograph of one of the big still lifes.
Oh, so this is what you were describing to me during the last visit. That is amazing. So it's what's depicted is, it looks like a dinosaur.
Yeah, it's a horse.
Skeleton. Oh, it's a horse.
Yeah. I make it weird.
I imagined it a dinosaur.
It's a horse.
I see a horse. It's a horse?
I have a whole bunch of horse skulls.
And then a human?
I have a cow.
I have a deer.
I have a whole bunch of these things. I find them in the desert and I bring them with me. So I have literally my skeletons in the closet out here. So. And occasionally, but you know, these paintings in the quote, Northfish Market, no matter how beautifully they're painted, no matter how thoughtful and clever they are, they go over like a lead balloon. So there's a real act of faith and real desire to make these paintings on my part, because I already know ahead of time what these people will tell me. So it's difficult to be an artist here in Portland, Oregon. I hate to be negative about it. But
well, it sounds like you've had some real life experiences to.
Yes.
Yes. So no worries about the negativity. It's based on experience. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. This is Art Focus, and you have been listening to the fourth in a series of pandemic studio visits, this one with Hank Pander. I'm Aurora Josephson, and I wish to thank Ava Lake, Joseph Gallivan, Ray Bodwell, and the other staff at KBOO, which helped make this segment a reality. Thank you. Also, we ask you art lovers out there to consider subscribing to KBOO on our website, KBOO.com. We hope you enjoyed the program.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. My man.
Bienvenidos a un breve informativo en su estación comunitaria KBOO 90.7 FM. Hoy martes 30 de marzo del 2021, en un artículo conjunto publicado en numerosos